Welcome to Power Talk, our interview portion. I am extremely excited to be sitting across the desk here from a gentleman who I've respected for many years. His name is Dr. Deepak Chopra. Dr. Chopra has a pretty phenomenal history, and many of you who have been with me throughout the years know how strongly I feel about the power of physiology to shape human emotion, human behavior, and ultimately our destiny. And the choices that we have to make along the way rather than giving the responsibility to somebody else. So to be with Deepak Chopra, I just want you to know this man, I believe, is one of the living masters in being able to teach people the fundamentals of what reality really is beyond the physical body, what really shapes our lives. So it's really a privilege to be with you, Deepak.
It's a privilege to meet you, Tony. I've admired you for a long time.
Well, thank you. We're here in Lancaster, Massachusetts, and we're at the Ayurvedic Center, Health Center here. And I think maybe what we could do is start out by just giving people a little bit of your background. You have a very traditional medical background, and yet now you're considered by most to be, I think, the foremost expert in the area of understanding mind-body medicine or psychoneuroimmunology. Why don't you give us a little background? Where did the shift happen for you?
The shift happened a while after I had been in practice. I was an academic to start with. I was teaching at Boston University School of Medicine and at Tufts and for a while at Harvard. And that part was so exciting from an intellectual point of view and so challenging that I was very happy doing that. But when I really started going into practice and seeing patients, I found that the academic intellectual challenges, exciting as they were, really had very little to do with how people got well.
Yes.
I was sitting there spending all my day writing prescriptions, and at the end of the day I would feel that I had been a legal drug pusher, because what was I doing? I was writing prescriptions for tranquilizers, sleeping pills, and antibiotics. If I ever told my patients, listen, maybe if you stop smoking or cut down on your alcohol or changed your weight, perhaps we could wean you off some of these drugs. And they'd say, well, you know, doc, my mother-in-law says the same thing. She doesn't charge me $50. How do I do it? And if you look back, you realize that medicine perhaps has all the answers, but it doesn't have the technologies to make people want to change.
Yes.
Or even if they want to change, doesn't have the technologies to show them how to change.
Yes.
It was very frustrating. So it was my unhappiness that led me out from what I was doing.
Pain drove you to something.
Yes, pain.
So what was the evolution of it then for you? Where did you begin to look? You were born in India, correct?
Right.
And so was your experience, your exposure to Ayurvedic medicine back then, were you going back to your roots? What triggered you to go there for the answers? Or did you start out there?
No, but actually I had a background in India, and some of it was a distorted perception of what Ayurveda was. I used to think of it as some kind of folklore or folk medicine.
Yes.
With a lot of herbology, but nothing more to it. In 1980, I started practicing transcendental meditation. In 1985, I was at a medical conference, and Maharishi was there in Washington. And after the conference, he sort of asked me to come to his room, which I did out of politeness more than anything else, because I wasn't interested in anything that had to do with quote-unquote mysticism.
Yes.
And I found him to be a very practical man. And we talked for a while, and he said to me that I should look, with my background in medicine, I should look into Ayurveda. I was polite enough to say that I would, but I didn't mean to. I left the meeting, and I went to the airport to go home. And at the airport, I met an old friend of mine from medical school, and he handed me a book. He said, this is about Ayurveda. Maybe you find it interesting. So I said, there's some message here.
Yes.
I read the book. It was fascinating. I went back to Maharishi. I said, send me to India. Let me meet all the people who are experts in it. I really want to get into this. And I did.
Wow. Now, at that time, were you the chief of staff at New England?
Yes, I was.
They must have thought you were crazy.
Yeah. Yes, I was. And initially, the response was, yes, that I was off the wall. My partners didn't know what I was up to. Some of them were even embarrassed about all the things I was engaged in. But I didn't care anymore.
You're on a mission.
I was on a mission, yeah.
Now, what began to make you believe that you really have found some answers here beyond your traditional medical training?
For one thing, I was able to influence people in a way I had never been able to do it. I was able to make them lose weight or stop smoking or give up alcohol, to make them want to be healthy. And then I started seeing some dramatic remissions in illness, in chronic illness. I'd have patients come here, for example, and they'd be taking 15 medicines, about 10 for their problem and 5 for the side effects from the medicines that they were taking. And within a week or two, we'd have them off everything, and they didn't have this problem anymore. They'd have bronchial asthma for 15 years, and now they don't have it anymore. Yeah. They've been taking drugs for arthritis for 10, 15 years, and it's not there anymore. And then when we started seeing occasionally a dramatic remission and somebody would say cancer, you start thinking, what's really happening here? Are we really, we've missed out on perhaps a few billion years of learning experience, because the human body, as it turns out, is an exquisite pharmacy. It makes every drug that Hoffman LaRoche makes and more.
Better quality.
Better quality, the right dose, the right target organ. No side effects.
Cheaper.
Cheaper. You have access to it, and all the instructions are there in the packaging.
Yeah.
So I said, and it's evolved over billions of years of evolutionary time. All the mistakes, you know, you can make the precise antibody for pneumococcus because some ancestor a few hundred thousand years ago perfected that technique, and you have it inside your body.
In your DNA.
In your DNA. So why not use this huge library of information?
So what prevents us from doing that?
Interference.
Social hypnosis?
Yeah, it's the hypnosis of social conditioning. It's violation of basic, simple laws of nature that make our body function. There are simple processes going on in our body all the time. The simple processes are eating, breathing, digestion, metabolism, elimination, and something that controls all of these, and that's consciousness. Thought, at a very fundamental level, non-verbal, not linguistically structured and verbally elite and speaking in the English language with an Indian accent, but at
a
communication,
at a cellular level.
A network of communication, a network of intelligence, communication and information, which is controlling all these processes. You get in touch with these processes, and you eliminate 95% of all disease. You can even reverse most of disease if you get in touch with these basic life processes. That leaves about 5-6% of disease, which is genetic. But even genetic disease is the stress of our ancestors. If we pay attention to what we are doing in our generation, we'll be doing the next generation a lot of good.
Makes sense. You and I both know from our mutual studies and individual studies that the power of belief to change biochemistry, to change instantaneously the way the body responds to anything, it's that sense of certainty. And some people are trying to pursue it through affirmations and pumping themselves up, but rarely does that really give you the sense of certainty. Whatever we're certain about really in our heart of hearts seems to show up in our body. And I think I read once you said that the body is a printout of our consistent thoughts or our consciousness. Tell me, what is the biggest misconception that we have about the human body? What is the metaphor that we're using that's keeping us locked in where we're always at the effect of rather than understanding we're truly the cause of our experience?
The biggest mistake is that we are steeped in the superstition of materialism. The superstition of materialism says that this world is made up of physical objects in space and time. And if there is such a thing as thought or consciousness, then it's the epiphenomenon of matter. In other words, if I have thoughts and feelings and emotions and desires and instincts and drives and likes and dislikes and passions and hatred, if I believe in God or heaven or hell or salvation or damnation or communism or feminism, all these things occur because there's the dance of molecules in my body. That biochemical reactions somehow produce the epiphenomenon that we call thought. That we are physical machines that have learned how to think. Well, in fact, it's probably
reverse,
the other way around. Not probably, surely the other way around. We are thoughts that have learned how to create the physical machine. We are impulses of intelligence in a larger universe of intelligence. This is a thinking universe. We are impulses of intelligence in a larger void of intelligence that have learned how to create physical matter. We create the mind. We are not the mind. We create the mind. We create the body. And through our body and our mind, we ultimately create the experience of the world. By itself, the world is just quantum soup. It's a radically ambiguous, ceaselessly flowing field of all possibilities. And out of that field of all possibilities, we can create anything we want. We're like King Midas. Only he knew only how to create gold. Everything he touched turned into gold. We can create anything we want.
Greater level of choice.
Much, infinite choice.
Yes. Tell me, what is the body?
If you went to a physicist, a really first-class physicist, and asked her, what's the real...
Asked her, I like that.
Asked her, what's the real nature of the physical body? She might say, if you could look at it, not through the artifact of sensory experience, then you'd see, which is, you know, the superstition that what I can see and touch and taste and smell is the way things only are. That's wrong. After all, my senses tell me that the earth is flat and nobody believes that anymore. The senses tell us that the ground we're standing on is stationary and we know it's spinning at dizzying speeds.
Or the light we see in the sky at night is still there when it may be gone millions of years ago.
Exactly. Yes. So forget the superstition of materialism and begin to see things as they really are. Well, the physicist would tell you that the body is a dynamic field of energy, information, and intelligence that's constantly renewing itself in every second of its existence. That you, in fact, make a new body once a year. That even this moment, you have a million atoms in your body that were once in the body of Christ, or Buddha, or Genghis Khan, or Leonardo da Vinci, or Saddam Hussein, for that matter. That your physical body is a river of intelligence and information. 98% of all the atoms come and go in less than 1 year. You make a new skin once a month, a new skeleton every 3 months, a new stomach lining every 5 days. Even the brain cells that you think with as carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, and oxygen, they weren't there 1 year ago. And the DNA, the genetic material, which holds millions of years of information, the actual raw material, the carbon and hydrogen and oxygen, comes and goes like migratory birds every 6 weeks.
So let me ask you a question. Somebody has cancer, and the first thing that the average person does, obviously, is immediately respond with horror, with fear. They immediately are told by their doctor they have so much time to live, or they have so much percentage of chance of living. They now think to themselves, I have this thing in my body I've got to get rid of. What you're saying is that thing in their body they call tumor is not going to be the same tumor a year from now. Is that true?
It's true. If I look at an x-ray and see a tumor and I compare it with the tumor from 6 months ago, am I really looking at the same tumor? The answer is, on the material level, no. Every single atom of carbon, of hydrogen, of oxygen, of nitrogen that makes up this tumor is not the same, is different from the tumor 6 months ago because of the rapid changeover.
Right.
However, because the underlying quantum mechanical framework is the same, in other words, the cellular memory is the same, or the underlying physiological processes at a non-material level are the same, it keeps coming back the same way. It's like if I had the ability to change every brick in this building once a year, but I'm stuck with the notion this is the only way to do it, I'd get the same looking building every
right.
time. If I want to get rid of this tumor, I have to exorcise the ghost of this tumor. And by the ghost of this tumor, I mean the impulses of information, energy, transformation, memory, conditioned response, all the things that structure the non-physical aspects of the tumor that result in this physical expression. It's estimated, for example, that we have 60,000 thoughts a day. That's not surprising. The disconcerting thing is that most people, 95% of the thoughts they have today are the ones they had yesterday. So we become bundles of conditioned reflexes and responses constantly being triggered by people and circumstance into very predictable biochemical outcomes, behavioral outcomes, mm-hmm. and ultimately physical outcomes. So, you know, the body turns over 6 billion cells a day. 1% of these are mutations. So everybody's body has cancer cells all the time.
That's right.
But we get rid of them every day.
Amplified. Problem is, though, if we keep putting the same cause in motion, the same thought cause, the same belief cause, the same expectation cause, then we're going to keep getting the same results because we're going to take the material and we're going to translate it accordingly. Is that
exactly,
what you're saying?
Exactly, exactly. The recipe remains the same. You can take the same ingredients, have another recipe, and you'll have something else.
Because we're funneling it in identical ways.
Exactly.
So until we change, it sounds complex, but what we're really saying is until we change our basic core fundamental beliefs, our sense of certainty about what is and what will be, then whatever we are certain about will be in our lives. Yeah, as we think, so
yeah,
we'll experience.
Exactly. In fact, Tony, what it is it's an interpretation of what's happening to you. If I go out on a joyride on Magic Mountain in Disney World, and my interpretation is at a deep level, somewhere, I believe, as you said, in the deepest part, this is fun. Then my body makes interleukins and interferons. These are powerful anti-cancer drugs.
That's right.
If you had to buy interleukin to treat melanoma or kidney cancer, a full course would cost you something like $40,000 and a lot of side effects. But you could take that joyride and make $1 million worth of interleukin too, if at the core of your being, you were having fun. On the other hand, if your interpretation was this is terror, then you'd make cortisol and adrenaline and all kinds of things which destroy the immune system.
Yes.
The difference between destruction of the immune system and stimulation of the immune system, a difference which could mean the crucial difference between life and death, is an interpretation.
You know, one of the things that I teach everyone is that your experience of reality is information times focus equals personal reality. And it's not just having the information, it's focusing upon it. Whatever we focus upon becomes real for us. So in any moment, there are millions of ways of focusing upon anything, interpreting, coming up with a meaning. Whatever meaning you come up with, you will feel. What you're saying is that whatever meaning you come up with, you'll not only feel, but the fact that you're feeling it, it becomes your reality biochemically.
The chemical, the molecule, is the meaning.
Wow.
The molecule is the meaning. If an experience, I take an experience and I say, this is a very tranquil experience. I'm having the experience of tranquility at a deep level of awareness. My body, my leukocytes, my adrenal cells, my macrophages will start churning out Valium. This Valium, unlike the one that you buy from Hoffman LaRoche, is the real diazepam. It is the molecule of tranquility.
Yes.
And it modifies and modulates the activity of the immune system so that cells can do their job in tranquility. The meaning that you give to an event is the event.
Because
is the event.
What I call it is the label you put upon experience becomes experience.
Exactly, because there is no such thing as actual reality. There is only the perception of reality.
That's correct.
See, and that perception of it is an interpretation that the self makes to the self.
So if you can become more effective at setting up your systematic way of interpreting life experience so that the meanings you consistently create are empowering in terms of emotions, then they're also going to be empowering in terms of physiology.
They structure, they become the physiology.
Wow.
See, the Vedic Rishi, from where this knowledge, my knowledge of Ayurveda comes, says, when I realize who I really am, I realize that I'm not in the body. The body is in me. I'm not in the mind. The mind is in me. I create both the body and the mind through my self-interaction. That's all there is.
You're saying that we aren't thoughts, we're the maker of the thoughts.
Yes, we are the thinker behind the thought, and that's in the gap between our thoughts. And in the gap between our thoughts is a little window, a little corridor, a little transformational vortex, you might say a little tunnel between which the individual mind and the cosmic mind communicate. The cosmic mind being a larger field of non-local field of information and energy. So if I say I'm going to take off my shoe, I could change that sentence to say I'm going to put on my shoe. Or I could say I'm going to make a phone call or I'm going to have chicken soup. Between the going to and the next word, a little gap of silence where there are infinite choices. So in every second of our existence, we have these little gaps where we are the thinker behind the thought who has the ability to make infinite choices.
And at any moment, we could change the choices we made in the past.
Right.
As long as we don't go into cultural or personal hypnosis where we get stuck in a pattern.
As long as we realize that we are not the thoughts, we are the thinker of the thought. The thought is something that I create through my own self-interaction. And for that, I think there's a moment if you take to stand behind and become a witness of the whole process, it's so obvious. that, you know, if I ask you to make a choice, choose this or this, I have two things in my hand.
I can always say I'll take this.
Or you can say you'll take this because you have infinite choice. Or I'll take nothing. I'll take that.
Right. Makes sense. Let's talk about placebos, because everyone's heard about placebos, but I don't think most people in our culture
realize what a placebo
is.
Yeah,
I really don't.
The word, in fact, you know, of course, the placebo, the word comes from the Latin root, I shall please.
Yes.
But what a placebo is the mechanics of creation. Originally, when placebos were found, they were discovered with analgesics, painkillers.
Yes.
So, and somebody found that if I gave you something which wasn't a painkiller, but you thought it was a painkiller, if I told you, look here, Tony, this is something that's going to kill your pain, and even inside there was nothing, not even sugar, yeah, it was biologically inert, then you would make something that would relieve the pain. And in fact, I could give you Narcan, which is a narcotic antagonist, and block the effect of the painkiller. In other words, the conclusion of this was that when you believed you were killing the pain with this drug, your body was making out stuff that was more powerful than any heroin you could buy on the street.
Wow.
Millions, in fact, 40,000 times more powerful than any heroin as a result of just the idea that this thing is really works.
Again, this is not an affirmation. This is not pumping yourself up. This is not trying to convince yourself.
No.
It's just somebody said, if you wear this garlic, I'll tell you what, you're going to have the pain disappear. You're going to smell so bad, you're going to run away.
Exactly.
But when people believe that, which means when they feel certain, they send the neurotransmitters out.
They hold this thought to be true. That's it.
That's it.
They hold this thought to be true, then the body sends out this heroin, which is more powerful than anything you can buy on the street. But now, the interesting thing is, I go to somebody else and I give them the same thing, and I say, this is going to get rid of your ulcer. Now, to get rid of the ulcer, you don't make heroin. You can't make a narcotic. You've got to make a very specific molecule. It's called an H2 receptor blocker. It has to interfere with hydrochloric acid binding to the receptors. So it's a very specific chemical. Now, I give you the same thing that I gave the other fellow who made heroin out of it. Okay? Now, I give him the same, this other person, the same thing. He makes an H2 receptor blocker. I go to a third person, and he has high blood pressure, and I need to lower his blood pressure. And for him, he needs another specific thing, which is called a beta blocker. It's another molecule.
Yes.
And the two couldn't be more dissimilar. He takes the same thing and he makes a beta blocker. Placebos work in cancer. You can go to somebody and you can say, well, this is a very effective chemotherapeutic drug. Not only will the cancer respond, but they'll, because they think it's chemotherapy, their hair will start falling out.
Yes.
They'll develop bleeding in the gums, and their platelet counts will also drop.
Yes.
So in each case, what you're doing is you're taking a belief, which is a thought, which you hold to be true, and converting it into a very specific molecule.
A biochemical reality in your body immediately.
Completely different printout.
So in essence, what you're saying then is, if we could just get control of our sense of certainty, that internal notion, as I think you call it, where we actually were the director of it, which we really are anyway.
Yeah.
We stop seducing ourselves or allowing others to be the director of our own thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
We can create any chemical we need to heal our bodies. And so what I'm hearing you say, is that true?
Yeah, because we are the makers of our bodies. You go to a deeper level in your awareness and you end up discovering that, in fact, you do create even the molecules of your body in every second of your existence.
Yes. Very powerful. Let's talk about nocebos, because just as a belief that something is going to heal your body can cause you to create the chemicals to make yourself healthy, the belief that something is going to destroy your body can create an equal challenge,
because,
can it not?
You see, nocebos are the opposite of placebos. And in Australia, for example, there's an Aborigine culture where if you don't like somebody, you can go to the local witch doctor. And the local witch doctor will give you a little stick, and he says, point the stick at the person that you don't like, and that'll take care of him. And so the person goes, takes the stick, and points at the person that he doesn't like, and after a while that person starts throwing up, starts having vomiting, and loses their appetite. They get emaciated, and within 1 week they're dead. See the effect of that idea, the word itself. There's an ancient expression, and first there was the word, and the word was made into flesh. Well, in today's scientific terminology, we can say first there was the quantum event, and that was made into the neuropeptide. But the fact is, that impulse of information literally translates into a space-time event. And that space-time event is a molecule in your body. So the word cancer is a nocebo. I say, Mrs. Smith, you have this breast cancer, it's metastasized to your lungs and bones, and you have only 3 months to live. Now, if she is a believer and she's simple, then she'll take that information and translate it into that reality.
When you say she's simple, you mean that she just accepts the doctor?
She accepts the doctor. She has relinquished her power to the words that come out from her doctor.
And who's a very caring man.
And
teaching what was taught him.
Yes.
Right.
But see, the statistics, what we call medical statistics, could be collective nocebos.
Yes.
Could be collective nocebos. I have read something in a certain manual, a scientific manual, and the scientific paper says in this particular disease, lung cancer, the mortality is 90% in 6 months. Now, I have no way of knowing when a patient walks into my office in which category he falls or she falls. She could easily be in the 10%. But because I have the statistic which I read, I reinforce it. You know, 90% chances are that you won't recover. Now, the poor fellow has gotten the wrong information because he could easily be in the 10%. In fact, maybe if we all started not employing these statistics,
maybe the percentage would change.
They would change.
Yes.
Because what the statistics are, a collective nocebo response.
Powerful. Now, I remember you quoted in one of your books a study that where they took, I believe it was rats, and they used camphor. And
right.
Why don't you share that study? That was very fascinating.
Well, they took rats and they gave them injections of a chemical called poly-IC, which is an immunostimulant. It stimulates the immune system. And then they had them smell camphor at the same time.
Right.
And after a while, the rats would just smell camphor and stimulate the immune system.
So neurologically, they'd been paired, or those listening, this is simply an anchor, as we call it.
An anchor, as you call it, and neuro-associative condition response.
That's right.
As you would call it.
That's right.
Now, you take another group of rats and you give them something that destroys the immune system and have them smell camphor at the same time. After a while, they'll smell camphor and destroy the immune system. Now, you have two groups of mice or rats. In one group, if you expose them to pneumococci, they get pneumonia and die of it in a few days. If you give them carcinogens, they get cancer and die of it in a few weeks. Nothing happens in the others. The crucial difference between survival and death in these mice is the interpretation of a memory that they have linked to a stimulus.
And again, I think the reason I brought this example up is this is not a conscious memory, as most people think in terms of consciousness, in terms of linguistics or communication. This is a neuroassociation, as we would call it.
Yes, but it's not only a neuro, it's a cellular association.
Yes, I understand.
Because the whole body is
at the deepest level.
At the deepest level.
Yeah. Because when I first started doing my work, one of the things I started to experiment with was taking people who had allergies and saying, listen, you know, we've done this anchoring where you change what your nervous system associates to something, or probably more accurately, what your cells associate to something. We've done that with emotions. You think of your boss, and we should have had to condition it now so that instead of feeling this pain and worry or upset or anger or resentment, or automatically now you feel good. You don't have to think about it. It's automatic. Let's try this with your allergy. And I'll never forget, think of a time when you really absolutely felt vital physically, where you could just storm through anything, where you felt like nothing could stop you. And I would create a series of anchors where I could just touch them, for example, and bam, just like the camphor, they felt immediately incredible. They were firing off biochemistry. I wasn't familiar with that level. I just knew what I could see physiologically in terms of their posture and their breathing. Then I'd say, okay, now we're going to bring this, you know, element in. And we did a variety of things, cat hair and so forth. You know, people had those types of responses. We would fire off the anchor, expose them, cat hair, fire off. Pretty soon, cat hair made them feel great. They weren't sneezing. They didn't have the response. And when I first started telling people that, they said, oh, this is anecdotal. But what I'm beginning to see now more and more, that this is, as you say, not just neurological, but at a deeper level, this is at a cellular level that we're conditioning ourselves in how to respond.
Yeah, and the cells are nothing other than fields of information. And those fields of information are nothing but self-interpretations. That's all they are. In fact, I'm sure you know of this condition called multiple personality syndrome, where a person may be diabetic and go into a diabetic coma in one personality, and another personality they don't have diabetes, but they have arthritis or something else.
Yes.
So their whole physiology changes. We take the same knowledge that you are talking of in terms of neuroassociative conditioning, and we use things like aromatherapy and condition, for example, a person to respond to the memory of a certain smell and teach them at the same time to slow their heart rate or get rid of the ulcer.
Wow.
So next time they have their ulcer pain, all they have to do is take a little bit of that smell, apply it over their upper lip, and the pain goes away. Or do you have hypertension, you just do it and the blood pressure falls.
Wow.
So it's very effective.
That's exciting.
Yes.
Well, you know, as you know, I'm sure olfactory is the most profound in terms of altering state of
right.
all the five senses,
yes.
and it's the deepest, I believe. Doesn't your nose develop before your brain develops
right.
as a fetus?
In fact, the nose, the olfactory bulbs are the hypothalamus. They're extensions
yes.
of the hypothalamus,
yes.
which is also called the brain's brain,
yes.
and it controls emotion, memory, autonomic function, which is all the things
yes.
that are happening spontaneously in the body. Or we think they're happening spontaneously. These things, along with memory, are very closely, intimately linked. And behavior, of course, is
yes,
an outcome of all that.
Of course. Well, I've been working at the grossest level called behavior. You've been working at the cellular level. I'm impressed.
Well, it's the same thing, actually.
Yes, well, they're completely
yeah,
tied. There's
yeah.
no doubt. Well, I remember reading, I thought a nice phrase, I may be paraphrasing it, but you said, you know, nothing happens in the mind, nothing happens without it happening in the body, I believe is
right.
what you said, something to the level. And I think most people just don't realize that when they let themselves just go
yeah.
behaviorally, or let themselves just go emotionally, that they're really letting themselves go biochemically.
Right. See, the thing is, we still have this idea that the mind and the body are two different things, but they're not.
Yes.
The body is a mind. In fact, the new terminology is body-mind.
Right.
And the body at a cellular level, go beyond the cells, you end up with molecules. Go a little beyond the molecules, you end up with atoms. You see, these atoms aren't material objects. They're particles. And the particles aren't material objects either. They're fluctuations of energy and information in a huge void of energy and information. So you get to so far beyond the facade of molecules, and you start ending up with a cloud of nothing. And you go beyond that cloud of nothing, and then you're left with absolutely nothing. But this absolutely nothing is the essential
raw material. That's what the something is.
It's the something is. The essential raw material of the universe is non-material. The essential stuff of the universe is non-stuff, but it's not just non-stuff. It's thinking non-stuff.
Hmm.
Because out of its own nature, it creates everything.
Well, people listen to us right now and hear this conversation, and some people, I think, will go into a deep trance and go, what is he talking about?
Well, maybe and, they'll get out of their trance.
Yeah, maybe they will. Maybe it'll wake up the trance. But I think we have to be able to stretch people's perceptions. Let's talk about something people are probably equally afraid of, or at least society is right now. Let's talk about AIDS. You know, you look at AIDS, and the majority of people in the population see this as something that if they were to all of a sudden take a blood test, which, as you and I both know, does not test whether they even have an AIDS virus.
Mm-hmm.
It tests whether or not they've had antibodies that
it's
have been linked to that.
It's a nocebo.
Exactly. But we're talking about a situation now in our culture where it's being promoted as the plague that's going to destroy our society. It's mm-hmm. begun to cause people to link to the act of making love with somebody mm-hmm. they care about. Could be something that could kill them. This mm-hmm. is what children are beginning to learn. I interviewed Dr. Duesberg. I don't know if you're familiar with him, from UC Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, as you know, is one of the co-discoverers of incontinence. And he said that, you know, HIV is not the source of AIDS. And he's attacking mm-hmm. all over the country, and he's pretty well qualified to do so.
Yeah, HIV is maybe a precipitating agent in a susceptible host. The material agent is never the cause of the disease. It may be the final factor
yes.
in inducing the full-blown syndrome in somebody who's already susceptible.
But what made them susceptible?
Their own interpretations of the whole reality that they're participating in.
Could that be translated into their thoughts, their feelings, their beliefs, their lifestyle?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It's not just as simple as
in fact, we have a lot of patients. I have a lot of patients with so-called AIDS, this label that we've given them,
yes.
that are healthier than most of the population that's living in downtown Boston. They haven't had a cold in 10 years.
Yes. But somebody's told them they have this disease.
Somebody's told them.
And they've bought into it
because,
in some cases.
Yeah, and the label is not the disease. The test is not the disease.
Well, talking to Duesberg, he said that physiologically, biochemically, all the HIV virus could ever do, or has ever been proven to do, is wipe out one out of every, I think it was 10,000 helpers, T helper cells.
That's right.
And how often are we, you know, being able to
facilitating that process through our own thoughts, beliefs, emotions, ideas, and interpretations.
From what he told me, we replace more of that in a day than they could ever be destroyed.
Absolutely.
And that's
right.
what he's promoting all over the country. Yet we've got a test out there that doesn't even test for the virus, that couldn't wipe out that many cells in the first place.
Right.
And people are accepting this. And when they accept it, what happens to them?
Well, when they accept it, then they make it happen. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Maybe they go take something like AZT, a side effect of which is immune suppression.
Also, yes. I mean, the implications of this are enormous, mind-boggling, and frightening.
Well, this kind of conversation, some people can listen to it. I'm sure even some people in the medical profession say, these guys are off their rocker. They could say that about me. It'd be pretty hard about you, although I'm sure they could push it.
Yeah.
What keeps us locked into this trap? What keeps us locked in this trap where we keep promoting a philosophy of fear where we must depend upon something or something, someone outside of ourselves to keep ourselves healthy?
It's a collective belief system. It's the hypnosis of social conditioning. It's cultural, religious, social indoctrination. And it's a trap, as you said. It's a real trap because usually when you're in a prison, you can at least see the bars. In this case, you can't even see the bars. Psychologists call this phenomenon premature cognitive commitment. Because you make it prematurely, it's not true. Cognitive, because it shapes your perceptual reality, you hold it to be true.
That's right.
And commitment, you're locked into it.
So what's the way out of the trap? Awareness?
Yeah, ultimately unbounded awareness, so that you realize that you are the field of all possibilities, that you have the ability to create anything. It's really that you are the magician behind the trick, that you are the creator behind the creation. To curve back within myself and keep creating, to know that, you have to expand your awareness, yes.
What would you say to somebody like... My personal belief in my experience, rightly or wrongly, that I've seen through time is that probably the greatest tool of influence is what I call social proof. That is, when people are uncertain as to what to do, they look around to see what other people are doing to decide. And we look around our society and we see a very unhealthy population. We see a population where 1 in 2 people are dying of heart disease, 1 in 3 are getting cancer. Certainly there are certain lifestyles that people have adopted that have made that happen, both physiologically, dietary, exercise, stress, thought process, all of these things together, a lack of happiness. But we see this being propagated, I think, by examples of people that influence us. We look at a person like Magic Johnson, phenomenal ball player, young man, and he had no symptoms at all. He went to go get a life insurance policy, which is part of what he's doing to protect his financial background, and he takes a test. A test that I was just reading in the Congress's Office of Technology Assessment, Dr. Larry Mike says that 9 in 10 times the test where it says you got a positive finding is wrong if you're a heterosexual. By the way, they say it's 10% of the time it's wrong if it says that you're okay and you're homosexual. I can't quite figure those statistics out, but here we've got a situation where he feels fine.
If he is, in fact, a heterosexual, and I know, and I think he is,
yes,
then the statistical likelihood of that is almost, of his having the disease,
yes,
is just, it's just impossible, almost impossible. If you knew how difficult,
yes,
it is for this virus to infect a male in the situations that we're talking about,
yes,
it just doesn't make any sense at all. And the test is... It's just...
A Western blot test,
yeah, it's a test. It's a, it could be false positive. In fact, most of them are.
What's interesting, though, is people's whole lives are then altered the minute they have this test.
Yeah, it's our collective consciousness and how it interprets reality. It then creates that reality. A collective consciousness influences. I'm sure you're familiar with the 100th monkey response and how if a certain...
Clarify it, though, so people know we're talking about...
Well, this very fascinating...
What island was that in?
It was one of the Japanese islands, Japanese island, where they introduced sweet potatoes into a monkey population. And the monkey population is unable to swallow these potatoes because they're mixed with sand and grit. And it takes about 6 months. And then in the first time it happened, one young monkey figured out that if you could take the potato and wash it in the stream of water, you could eat it.
Yes.
So immediately some of the younger monkeys started following this potato washing technique. But some of the older ones had to wait and see if this was a new cult or something that had sprung up in the monkey population. In any case, once you reach a certain threshold, and it's not very much, it's 1% or so of the population that's practicing this particular potato washing technique. Then if you cross that threshold, then suddenly the whole behavior of the entire population changes.
And this was on other islands as well, true?
Other islands. So
There was no communication between the monkeys where they could be modeling each other visually.
Absolutely. So 99 is a metaphor. The 100th monkey joins the force, and then suddenly, because a certain threshold has been reached,
yes,
everybody believes that that's true.
And we see that in science. We even see that at the level of fashion.
Yes.
You know, and not only where people are seeing it because the media is exposing it, but where things will just spring up in different parts of the world where there has not been any communication. Different scientists all of a sudden have the same breakthrough who have not been talking to each other.
In fact, I think it's the mechanics of evolution. We are reaching a stage where Jonas Salk said, we've finished with biological evolution. We're in the midst of metabiological evolution, which means the evolution of consciousness. And ultimately, of course, the evolution of consciousness of consciousness. So we are at a stage where ideas are becoming the evolutionary force rather than genes.
Yes.
Genes were packets of information, but they've done their job. Now, ideas become the memes. The word is memes because memory and memes. Hmm. The word is memes. These are non-material space-time events that are going to shape the evolution of what happens to humanity. It's our collective thinking. Now, I was at the Berlin Wall when it fell down. I happened to be in East Berlin, and everybody was celebrating that day. The divisions between East Germany and West Germany had fallen. Communism had gone. There was a big neon sign with Karl Marx underneath the statement, "Sorry, chaps. It was just an idea."
Oh, I love it. But human beings, out of their need, I think, for a sense of certainty, my personal belief is, I think you know from exposure to my work, is that everything that drives human behavior at some level is the need to avoid pain, the desire for pleasure, at least at the level of behavior. And human beings seem so committed to being able to avoid pain at any cost that they'll endeavor to, maybe not endeavor, but they're willing to maintain the pain that they've got because at least they understand it and have some way of dealing with it rather than trying to deal with the unknown. And I see so often where someone, and I'm sure you've seen this, where someone would rather have a label for their current, you know, dysfunction in their body that almost they get excited about. They're excited to know now that they have this disease. Have you seen this experience?
It's such a tragedy. You know, in Vedic tradition, we have a saying, you need freedom, and you need freedom from the known. The known is what you need to be free of, because the known is the rigid patterns of past conditioning. The known is the trap. What you do need to do, if you want to be free, step into the unknown in every second of your life. And then you'll be free. And then create from that unknown. Because the unknown is the field of all possibilities. It's everything.
But for most people, the unknown is the field of fear. For most people, what the unknown means is I could get hurt. And most people are not willing to take that jump.
They
the majority
should be
of people.
Fearful, if anything, only from the known. Because that's what the trap is.
I would agree
the
with you.
The trap is the known,
I would
not
agree
the
with
unknown.
I
the unknown is all choices.
I would agree with you. Let me bring you back to AIDS one more time. My focus on it is only because it's in the headlines every day, and I think it's a great metaphor. Going back to somebody like a Magic Johnson, they convinced him, of course, to take AZT, which, you
horrible,
know.
Horrible travesty.
What does AZT do to the body?
AZT will destroy the immune system even more. And in fact, it causes all kinds of side effects. And there are statistics now that show beyond a shadow of doubt that AZD does nothing to the long-term morbidity or mortality of the disease.
In the very beginning, it was passed after only being used for, was it 3 or 4 months initially?
Right. Wow.
And it was like, you know, tossing a coin for a short period of time.
You know, there's a lot of money involved in all this.
Yeah, this is true. Also, I read recently that in terms of AIDS that I was reading an article and they were talking about that if you've ever had any kind of shot that had gamma globulin in it, that you will come up very easily. You can come up with
lots of false positives.
Yes,
false. Not just gamma globulin. There are all kinds of antigens that are out there in the environment that can induce a false positive. In fact, I have a person which I will not identify right now, who has held the world record for swimming and continues to hold it periodically, who has the same positive test but doesn't have the disease.
Now, in the very beginning, they said, well, this was what always fascinated me. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't know of any disease where if you have the antibodies, it means you have the disease up until AIDS. I mean, the fact that you have antibodies should be showing that the body is doing its job, should it not?
All it means is that you've been exposed to an antigen.
Yes.
That's it. And in this case, we don't even know if the antigen is the
cause of
specific
such a syndrome.
You see, HIV is one particular antigen.
Right.
There are thousands of antigens that have the same structure, can elicit the same antibody response.
Interesting. Well, also the symptoms of AIDS, I believe there's 167 diseases that have the same symptoms, and they keep expanding the definition.
Yeah, they keep expanding. I think we're creating a monster collectively.
Well, the biggest monster I see is the fear, because fear, I think I read you had a wonderful definition of stress. Because I think you were talking about aging, which I want to come to, but not yet. But you had a great definition. You said, I believe, that stress is really not based upon what's happening in the environment. It's our interpretation of threat. Is that correct?
It's our interpretation of physical or psychological threat. It's not in us. It's not in the environment. It's in our interpretation of what we think is happening to us. And a good, Dr. Ken Pelletier, I believe, many years ago gave the analogy. He said, compare it to the waves on an ocean. If you're a skillful surfer, then every wave is joy and exhilaration.
Exciting, sure.
It's exhilaration.
Yes. And you're creating the appropriate biochemicals that come with that.
That come with that. On the other hand, if you're not prepared, then the first wave is a disaster.
Yeah.
So the same stimulus can be either threatening or stressful, or the same stimulus can be joyful, exhilarating, energizing, bliss.
So again, when we come back to what is the solution, it appears that to constantly expose yourself and seek the unknown, to constantly pursue what I would probably call profound knowledge, that is information that helps you to understand and interpret in a broader and a deeper sense the quality of your world.
And something that you do very effectively, and that is learn how to perceive your interpretations. Learn how to, you do it very effectively. You show people that, you know, you're locked into this reality because you made a certain neuro-associated conditioned response.
Yes.
Okay, but that's all it is. Now we'll replace this neuro-associative conditioned response with this other neuro-associative conditioned response. That's very effective. To give people the insight that what's happening to them is a result of certain interpretations and certain memories that they've been locked into it.
Yes.
Now we change that. And then there's a deeper level of reality. And this, I feel, is very important to get in touch with that aspect of yourself, which is not subject to change. We've spoken
the
about the body, we've spoken about the mind, but there's something which is more primordial to both the body and the mind, and that is the spirit.
Yes.
I am the experiencer, not the experience, even though, of course, I get locked into these experiences. But in every experience, there is a part of me that is still unchanged.
Yes.
It's the experiencer. If I can find the experiencer in the midst of every experience and get in touch with that experiencer, I'll discover that the experiencer, the original experiencer, is just a silent witness that never changes. It's that non-changing part of myself.
And that's the part of you that's without fear.
That's part of you that's without fear, because all fear ultimately is the fear of change. It's the fear of mortality. And that part of you is immortal. It doesn't know any kind of change. It's absolute.
Well, that's interesting. If, you know, what we're really saying is that consciousness really is what shapes all forms of destiny, physical, emotional, psychological, spiritual.
Yes.
And that, in essence, if we choose to finally realize that we can direct that consciousness, that we can direct everything we experience in life.
Yes, consciousness is a field of all possibilities. It's pure potentiality. Einstein defined the field when he was talking in terms of space-time field-matter analogies. He said, in the new reality, in the new physics, there's no place for both matter and the field. The field is the only reality. And the field, instead of being an actual model for space-time events, it's the continuum of all possible states of energy and information that subsequently manifest as space-time events. And I am the field.
You're speaking of the unified field? Are you speaking of what
I'm
people
speaking
call the
unified
field?
Yes, I'm speaking of the unified field.
Okay.
In my, all of matter ultimately boils down to force fields. And
right.
These force fields are also information fields.
Yes.
Ultimately, they come from the field, which is one unified field from where everything comes. And my basic substrate, my ultimate ground, is that unified field. Now, other traditions have called it the spirit, or they've called it consciousness, or they've called it what you will, call it God if you want. But the fact is that there is a deeper level inside us from where we think, from where everything comes. Get in touch with that also. Learn.
How do you get in touch with that?
Well, I practice meditation. I meditate. And I tell all my patients that take a little time. You have appointments with everybody else in the world.
Have one with yourself.
Have one with yourself.
What a concept.
Have one with yourself. You're going to be doing a lot of things. You're going to be thinking a lot of thoughts. But ultimately, you're a human being and not a human thinking and a human doing. You're a human being. So take a little time and just be. And then come out. And you'll feel when you infuse your activity with that being, with that spiritual aspect with yourself, of yourself, then everything will be different.
Give us three keys to getting someone in that state where they feel connected to the part of themselves that's eternal, the part of themselves that gives them the experience of life.
Well, I'll give you a quote from Franz Kafka, which is very beautiful. He said, "You need not do anything. Remain sitting at your table and listen. You need not even listen. Just wait. You need not even wait. Just become still, quiet, and solitary, and the world will freely offer itself to you to be unmasked. It has no choice. It will roll in ecstasy at your feet."
Wonderful. Beautiful. I think the key that I would add to that is then not to judge what shows up.
Yes, not to judge, not to
have... Am I doing it right? Did I have a real experience?
Yeah, not to judge. You see, we spend all of our days judging and defining and labeling, etc. And then we end up, of course, with the wrong labels also. But take a little time to be without labels, judgments, definitions, descriptions, evaluations, interpretations, and you'll suddenly be free.
Very nice. Let's talk a little bit about patterns. You and the Ayurvedic tradition have developed a knowledge or a set of distinctions that can help us to understand how to keep ourselves in balance, both mentally, emotionally, philosophically, spiritually, health-wise, through patterns of, I guess it would be neurological, physiological body types. Can we talk about maybe the three primary ones? I know there's 10.
Yeah, there are three primary body types. One we call Vata, which is the hypermetabolic body type, where everything is in motion, the body, the mind, the emotions. Things change fast. The main factor is, to emphasize, is hypermetabolic type. So this is the kind of person who reacts fast to everything. And under normal circumstances, enthusiastic, vivacious, imaginative, lots of fun to be with, get them under stress, the same things manifest as anxiety and insomnia and muscle tremors and cramps and menstrual tension and constipation and irritable bowel. And this is the kind of person who says, "I can eat anything I want and never gain weight." The extreme opposite of that is the Kapha, hypometabolic type.
Right.
Under normal circumstances, easygoing, effortless behavior, affectionate, loving, sympathetic. Get the same person under stress, then they start holding on to things. They're the kind of people that say, "All I have to do is look at food and I gain weight."
Yes.
And they retain food, they retain fluid, they hold on to everything, whether it's food, fat, fluid, or relationships for that matter. Then there's the fiery metabolic type or Pitta type.
Yes.
Here the underlying principle is fire. These people are like yourself, for example, articulate, chivalrous, courageous, very effective.
I'll slip you the tip later on.
Okay. But get these people under stress, and the stress being the interpretation which we talked about, then the same thing manifests as ulcers and hypertension and type A personalities and heart attacks and so on.
Anger.
So anger. Anger.
Frustration.
But frustration. But the nice side of it is passion.
Yes.
So, you know, in balance, that same passion. And in imbalance, anger and frustration and impatience. So if three people get in a traffic, stuck in a traffic jam, one person acts anxiously, another gets angry, and the third might tune into Mozart. Or whenever we are reacting to anything in life, whether it's the rainy weather, or whether it's a love note, or whether it's criticism from a boss, or whether it's an item of food or a traffic jam, actually, we're not reacting to that at all. We're reacting to a self-generated signal.
Yes.
And these patterns, to get in touch with these patterns, give us an idea that there are certain psychophysiological tendencies or propensities to the extent I can get in touch with the patterns that seem to be more obvious to me as relating to me, the more control I have over the situation and the more insight I have. You know, a few weeks ago, it was a snowy day. I was in Chicago at the airport and they suddenly announced that the flight had been canceled because the weather was bad and there was a snowstorm. I saw all the Vata people rushing off to the other counter. They were already booking tickets on the next flight. The Pitta people were banging their fists on the table and screaming at the woman who made the announcement. And the Kapha people had gently sauntered to the ice cream parlor and were having
to deal with their stress with some food.
Yeah. That's so right. You see now how conditioned this response is, even on a massive level.
Well, let me clarify with you, though, also. Don't we have all three within us? Is there a predominant, for example, I know you're familiar with visual, yeah, auditory, and kinesthetic,
right,
types.
Right. Yeah, we have all three, and some people are more dominant in one.
Right.
We are all a combination, so we can end up being 10 body types.
I see.
And in fact, the visual, kinesthetic, olfactory, gustatory,
yes,
they're all accounted for in this system also of body types.
It sounds like the Kapha would be a very kinesthetic body type.
And olfactory also, and gustatory.
Yes. Well, that makes sense,
yeah,
and that's why they tend to gravitate towards,
yeah,
food.
Whereas the Vata auditory and the Pitta visual.
Yes. And if I remember correctly, the Vata also wants the tactile, the kinesthetic.
You're right.
Or as a normal human being would say, the touch.
Right.
Interesting. Now, let's talk a little bit about this. If I remember, you had some other distinctions. For example, I think Vatas need to make sure that their meals are somewhat consistent in terms of timing. They tend to have, if I remember correctly, difficulty with sleep being,
yes,
altered real easily.
Yes.
Do they respond to cold with more difficulty?
Yes, Vata body types have dry skin. They're ectomorphic. Their skin and veins are more prominent. Their tendon knee protuberances can be seen easily. They are hypermetabolic, moving around all the time. They are sensitive to cold. And when they get out of balance, then they have all the things we already mentioned.
Right.
Whereas, and they are tactile, kinesthetic, and auditory.
Right.
The Kapha people are emotional. And they, as I said, they have more fat under their skin.
Yes.
Their skin is moist and cool. Their bony tendencies are not prominent, protuberances are not dominant, and they have more tendency towards fluid retention, diabetes, high cholesterol, holding on to all the things. Emotionally, they can become very possessive and attached.
Yes.
The Vata types, on the other hand, become anxious more easily. And the Pitta types are more fiery metabolic, so they're more mesomorphic, more muscular. And under stress, then all the elements of fire come out, anger and frustration and jealousy and things like that.
But like temperature, for example, my wife is always freezing. I'm always burning up.
Yeah, well, you're then Pitta, you know, and she's Vata.
Yeah, that's
temperature, cold. Vata, the characteristic is cool and dry. Kapha, cool and moist, and Pitta, hot and moist.
Interesting. I have to tell her I'm hot and moist, baby. There we go. It was fascinating. Now, how do we create balance? First of all, what creates imbalances in each three?
Stress.
These three?
Stress. So, ultimately, it's all stress.
So what are some of the elements of stress?
The elements of stress are basically how you interact with your environment, with people and situations and circumstances and
so
things.
Emotional stress, physical stress from lack of sleep, stress,
yes,
from eating improperly.
Right. In fact, take two or three things. How you behave, how you think, how and what you eat, period. How you behave influences your biological rhythms, which means life is a function of cycles of rest and activity.
Yes.
So deep rest is the basis of dynamic activity, mm-hmm, and dynamic activity is the basis of deep rest. If you've had a really good dynamic active day, you're going to have a wonderful sleep at night.
Yes.
It's like children. Look at children. They're totally self-referral. They're totally in the present.
Yes.
And when they fall to sleep, they're gone. That's what blissful sleep is. And just like that, deep rest is the basis of dynamic activity. If you have a hangover, you're not going to be able to do anything effective. So
yes,
you need both.
Yes.
And nature functions in these cycles of rest and activity. So watch the signals of comfort and discomfort as they come from your body. These are your inner cues. The universe, in its infinite intelligence, has made it very simple. There are only two signals. One's a signal of comfort, one is the signal of discomfort.
Pain
the signal
and
of yes, exactly.
Yes.
Or we say joy and suffering.
Yes.
Okay? These are the only two signals. And you tune into these signals that your body is giving out and amplify the signals of comfort and get away from the signals of discomfort, you have what is called spontaneous right action, which means the right action comes to you in every second of your existence. It's the right response to every situation as it occurs. There's a computing system out there which is far more precise, far more accurate, far more reliable than any contained in the realm of rational thought. You just have to tune in. Tune into the signals, and you have the right behavior, the right eating habits. Of course, there are guidelines, and those guidelines are something for you to corroborate your own inner experiences.
Right.
There's no animal in the forest who has the vaguest idea what the U.S. Surgeon General has recommended as the minimal requirement of calcium.
It's probably why he doesn't have loss of bone and he doesn't have cancer in the wild.
Osteoporosis,
anyway.
Yes.
Yes.
Exactly. Inner cues.
Well, you know, I asked you earlier, how do you really get to that place where you know you're the creator of your world? And it sounds like one of the ways to do it is be a child again.
Be child.
Children have the curiosity. Children are not locked in. It's like you start out as a child, the door is wide open, then we learn more and more, and we keep closing the door until there's a very thin amount of light that can get through to us.
Yeah, locked into the known.
Interesting. Tell me some ways to balance, though. You gave me the general, which is notice the things that make sense. But those three types, what would be some ways of balance?
Well, the three body types, the vata body types, food, for example. The vata pacifying foods are those foods which have tastes of sweet, sour, and salt. By sweet, I don't mean concentrated sweets as in candy, but complex carbohydrates, for example, that have that sweet aftertaste. Kapha body types are balanced more easily by pungent, bitter, and astringent.
Yes.
Astringent, and pitta body.
Is that body, because they're used to not moving or just being in one mode and you want to stimulate them?
Right. And the tastes aren't what nature gave us as information states. And we use the taste to access the information that's there in food. And then the pitta body types are balanced most easily by astringent, bitter, and sweet. These are the three tastes. And vata types need more rest because they are very easily hypermetabolic and they need more regularity in their life.
Yes.
And pitta types need more precision also. Kapha types can go for a long time and have a lot of endurance. If you get, ultimately though, even if you didn't know all this, Just notice what works. Listen to the inner cues, and the body's inner intelligence is the ultimate and supreme genius. It mirrors the wisdom of the universe. It'll tell you exactly what to do. Most people don't take time to listen.
Get quiet and listen, huh?
Get quiet and listen.
Meditation. I recently was under a fairly amount of stress in the way I was interpreting my world by creating so many timelines and deadlines. And I had been doing that for such intensity. And I finally took a trip with my family and went up to Aspen. And first 2 days, I was still in that mode. And after 3 or 4 days of being there, just being out in the snow and just relaxing and being, it was like it's rejuvenated
me
so much.
Timeless part of yourself.
That's right.
There is a timeless part, you know. When you're in love, then time doesn't matter.
Yes. What about time? Does time exist?
Not really. Sir Thomas Gold, most eminent physicist on this theory of time, says the flow of linear time is a purely psychological event.
Yeah, it's our construct. We've made it up.
Yeah, we've made it up. Stephen Hawking, this universe has no beginning, no ending, no outer edges in space.
Yes.
It's a timeless, eternal continuum. And we are part of that timeless, eternal continuum. We go through a set of experiences and behind that set of experiences, the experiencer is always there. The experiencer is always there. And the universe is without time. You know, I read about a case report from Germany recently where 7 miners were trapped in a mine. And one of them had a watch. And in order to allay the anxieties of the others, every time 2 hours passed by, he would call out 1 hour. At the end of the week, they were all rescued. And they were all alive, except for the one who was calling out the time.
Wow.
He had them collectively change their agreement of what constituted objective time. But he got locked into an interpretation.
Wow, what a great example. Well, most of us use time as an enemy instead of as our ally. In fact, I remember reading, I think it was in one of your books, about the fact that more people die on Monday.
At 9 o'clock.
At 9 a.m. than any time of the week.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary, unique accomplishment for which only the human species can take credit for that one. And presumably no other animal knows the difference between Monday and Tuesday.
Wow, that's fascinating. Now, you tied this into the whole understanding of job satisfaction affecting someone's health.
Yeah, the two most important risk factors for heart disease and predictors of fatal heart attacks One, job dissatisfaction, people who have no meaning or purpose to their life.
Yeah.
And the second most important risk factor is what's called self-happiness rating. You can go out on the street and ask people two simple questions. Do you have any meaning in your life? Do you have any purpose in your life?
Yeah.
Number two, are you happy? And if they can say comfortably yes to both, they're going to be fine.
And whether they're happy or not all comes down to how they wired themselves to interpret their world.
Their world, yeah.
And that's why I see happen a Date with Destiny. You know, people come in for 3 days and they start out with all this pain inside because they've set up a game they can't win.
Right.
You know, and so no matter what happens, they're never happy. And then you make it so that the game is natural and their lives transform.
Yeah, the first thing is they have to realize that they set it up.
Yeah, and most people don't. Mm-hmm. Tell me entrainment. I was fascinated by this idea of entrainment. Can you talk a little bit about that for a moment?
Sure. You've seen a flight of birds in the sky.
Yes.
And suddenly you'll see that all of them will change direction all at the same time. There's no time for the leader to signal to the rest that, you know, we've got to make a left turn or a right turn. They all do it at the same time because all their collective brains are on the same frequency. Or you've seen a school of fish and they move as one swarm, one organism. You take a baby and put it next to its mother's breast. After a while, the baby's heart rate and the mother's heart rate will entrain. They'll have a rhythmic relationship. The breathing will entrain. If you and I are agreeing over certain things and we hook up our brains to an oscilloscope, we'll find the same flow, the same pattern. You won't be able to tell the difference between the brain waves that you have and I have. Or if people are in love, that's the same thing. Or close, intimate, physical relationship entrainment occurs.
When it happens in a non-relationship-oriented thing. I remember reading about clocks.
Yes, you can start their pendulum swinging at different times, and after a while they'll all be swinging to the same rhythm. You have a number of women living together in a convent or a prison. After a while, they all have the same menstrual cycle, the same periods.
Yes, I read about that. It's
so
amazing.
There is a tendency in this universe for information to flow smoothly. And the way it happens is, even though we think, by and large, that we are very unique individuals who have our own thoughts, you know, Nietzsche once said, he said, you live under the presumption that you think, where in fact, most of the time, you are being thought.
So much for us being the creator of our experience.
No, huh? Until you realize that in fact, you could influence that whole collective consciousness also.
Right.
And that's what the purpose of things like what you and I are doing
exactly.
here is to influence that collective consciousness so that we change it into a better world, give it more meaning, give it more purpose, and to make happy should be the purpose of life.
And the way to do that is to empower individuals to remember that they are that source. That
and
they're
then
the creator.
Individually, then collectively,
that's right.
then biologically.
The more that know that individually, the more we'll collectively.
The world will change.
The way to become invincible is to, what
to
was
become
the
become defenseless. Lose your attachment to the defense of your point of view, then there's nothing to attack. There's a Vedic aphorism. It says, when we are completely established in nonviolence, then all beings around us cease to feel hostility. Because even the signals that you send out change, and it's true. A seer, a rishi in a forest, and the birds will light up and on his knees, and the snakes will coil up around his neck and his legs, and nothing hurts him because nothing around him feels that hostility.
Yeah.
And you know this, I'm sure you're familiar with this whole idea of pheromones.
Yes.
These are hormones
yes.
that are released
yes.
as a result of our emotional states.
And making me smelled, I believe.
Yes. So if you take mice and you give them electrical shocks and you remove them from the room and you bring other mice in, then as soon as they enter the room, they panic because they inhale the hormones of fear.
Yes.
So now...
And human beings do this as well.
Oh, yeah. Every emotional state has its own hormonal milieu, which is not confined to the body, but is released from the body and influences other people. So when you say, I went into this room and the atmosphere was really tense, it's a physiological fact. Or when you say, I went to this holy shrine and I felt peace, love, and compassion, that's a physiological fact. Or when you say, you know, I don't know what it is about this chap, but he certainly gives me the creeps. That is also a physiological fact.
Yes.
Emerson once said, who you are shouts so loudly in my ears, right. I cannot hear what you're saying.
Yes.
It's a physiological fact.
Well, in both our businesses, I'm sure you can experience it walking into a facility.
Yes.
You know, and our goal, at least my goal, going in a facility, I walked in yesterday right around the corner from here, and we had 2,900 people. It was a really interesting state. But my goal is to be able to walk in a room and as an individual
change it
for 2,900 people in a moment. And then once I've done that, to show them that not only did I do this, but that they allowed me to do this, and that they can now do this themselves at any time in any environment.
Right.
That it is not the environment, but it is you who creates the experience.
Yes.
And that you can shape the environment. It goes beyond just shaping your own environment. You can become a source of certainty
because
in an uncertain
world. Because
the
environment is your extended body.
Wow. That's
it's your extended body.
Powerful metaphor.
I call this the environment, the universe. It's not. It's my cosmic body. And this is my personal body.
Wow.
And I have influence over it as much as I have over my body. If I can wiggle my toes at the flicker of an intention, I can do that with my cosmic body too.
And every great spiritual teacher throughout human history has both professed this and demonstrated to those who have enough faith to be able to perceive and experience. Tell me something. I've taken you for much more time, and I'm going to miss my plane, but I want to make sure before we wrap up here that I give people a way to reach you and get some aspects of some of your newest products. And so those who'd like to order your tapes or your books can reach you, I believe, at 1-800-858-1808. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
So once again, 1-800-858-1808. You have a product called The Higher Self, The Magic of Inner and Outer Fulfillment. Tell me a little bit about what is in that product. What's that about?
It's about how desire is really pure potentiality seeking manifestation. Mm. That inherent in having the desire is the mechanics for its fulfillment.
Yes.
That the desire is in fact the mechanics of creation.
Yes.
And really this series is about accessing that part of yourself where every desire must come true. The universe is a big dream.
Yeah.
And we should participate in it. It's so exciting and so much fun.
Well, desire in Latin's of the Father.
Right.
So, desire, that's interesting. And just finishing up, I have a couple questions for you. What's the purpose of life?
The purpose
I like asking these simple questions.
The purpose of life is the expansion of happiness.
Oh, I like that.
And that's a quote, by the way, from Maharishi.
Ah,
if you ask me what is the purpose of my life, it is to do three things. To heal, to make people that I come into contact with happy, and to create peace.
Mm, it's beautiful. Where will we find you 10 years from now?
In the field of all possibilities.
Well, that's a broad enough category. I like that. Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. And if I ask
still you... Still stepping into the unknown in every second of my existence.
That's nice. Well, I hope we'll be doing that together as friends.
I'm sure. I mean, I can, you know, the pheromones are really good.
How do you want to be remembered?
Made a little difference.
That's nice. That's nice. I think the accurate one is a big difference already.
We'll see.
And I think that those who listen to this, hopefully what this will do is begin for them a new level of their journey into the unknown with joy
instead
of fear.
Thanks, Tony. It was fun having you here.
Thank you so much. God bless you.
God bless you too.